I tried throughout my PhD thesis to look at all these different facets and aspects of her work. I would say she was mainly a social documentarist. And then there is these small fractions of artistic explorations she did throughout the Bauhaus and her commercial work as well. I just try to enhance how multifaceted she was, that we all in life don't play just one single role. We have all these different aspects to us. My name is Dr. Stephanie Pirker.
My name is Anja Guttenberger, and this is my podcast, Bauhaus Faces. Welcome back to a new episode of Bauhaus Faces. After the last two episodes on three members of the Red Bauhaus Brigade, all of them architects, all of them men, we now return to a woman who studied photography at the Bauhaus, Edith Tudor Hart. Generally known as the spy with a camera, this episode asks, what do we see when we stop looking for the spy and start looking at her photographs, collages and publications? Edith Tudor Hart has too often been seen through a story that is not primarily about her work, but about secrecy, politics, and the men around her. Several publications have linked her to the Cambridge Five, the group of British men who spied for the Soviet Union. It is a dramatic story, but it can easily overshadow everything else. What we see is a remarkable photographer of social realities, poverty, housing, children's welfare, women's health, and the sharp inequalities of 1920s and 30s Austria and Britain. We see a Bauhaus student, a communist, a migrant, a mother, and an artist who understood photography as a tool of social critique and education. Edith Tudor Hart came to the Bauhaus in Dessau in October of 1929, when she was still Edith Suschitzky from Vienna. She studied photography for only one semester, but at a significant moment, under Hannes Meyer, when the Bauhaus had become increasingly politicized and when photography had just entered the school as a formal class. The timing for this episode could hardly be better. A new exhibition has just opened here in Berlin at the Museum für Fotografie called Neue Frau, Neue Sehen, die Bauhausfotografinnen. New Woman, New Vision, the female Bauhaus photographers. Edith Tudor Hart's work is part of that exhibition too. My guest today is Stephanie Pirker, who has just completed her PhD in art history with a dissertation on Edith Tudor Hart. She also curated an exhibition on Tudor Hart for Fotohof in Salzburg, Austria, later shown at the Isokon Gallery in London. I saw it there last November, bought the catalogue, read it in one go, and was struck by how urgently Tudor Hart's work asked to be seen beyond the spy story. Before we begin today's episode, I'd like to quickly share something with you. A few people have asked me how they could support me in Bauhaus Faces, which is incredibly kind. So I've now set up a support option through Ko-fi. I love making this podcast, researching the stories, writing the episodes, recording them, editing the audio and sharing them with you. But as an independent podcast, there are also costs involved. I pay for the tools I use to record, edit and improve the sound, for the services that help me publish and distribute the podcast, and sometimes also for travel connected to research, interviews or visiting places linked to the people I talk about. So, if you would like to support Bauhaus Faces, you can now do that on Ko-fi. You have the option to make a one-time contribution or to support the podcast on a monthly basis as bronze supporter for €3 per month, silver supporter for €5 per month and gold supporter for €7 per month. You can find the support option directly on Ko-fi or on the podcast website bauhausfaces.com. There it appears as a purple floating button in the lower left corner of the page with a coffee cup and a little heart on it. Of course, I will link both in the show notes for you. And I really want to stress this. Please don't feel any pressure. The podcast will stay free, it will stay independent, and it will stay free of advertising. I'll still do my best to publish one episode a month as always. Whether you support the podcast financially, share it with a friend, leave a 5-star rating on Spotify or Apple Podcasts, leave a kind message or simply listen, all of this helps and is deeply appreciated. Every listener matters to me. Thank you for being here. Let's now dive into a new episode of Bauhaus Faces and shine a light on Edith Tudor Hart.
when in December 2018, Wolfgang Suschitzky's, so Edith Tudor Hart's brother's estate came over to Futterhof, there has been a part of her estate that has not been discovered so far in his estate. So four boxes of approximately 1,500 negatives, which then I started digitizing and researching on. And basically from there, we did a little exhibition in the archive at Futterhof. And through that gradual work, that process over the last 5.5 years, her archive gradually shifted over to Austria. So part of it has been with the National Galleries in Edinburgh. And from there, it went to Salzburg. So the family basically wanted to reunite Wolfgang's and Edith's estate in one archive. And yeah, it's been a pleasure and a great possibility for me to work directly with the material. And then I started doing my PhD on her life and photographic work. Edith in Vienna, she became a photographer and then had this very short window where she studied at the Bauhaus. And her younger brother followed her footsteps, becoming a photographer. But he studied in Vienna and had more of a naturalistic, objective approach to photography. And Edith emigrated to the UK in 1933 because she was married to a British, Alexander Tudor Hart. She was able to escape Austria and persecution because she was a communist. And her brother later in 1935 also escaped Vienna. And first he went to Holland with his first partner. And then he went to England, where he settled and became quite a renowned photographer and videographer. Wolfgang Suschitzky died 2016. He sent Edith's estate to Edinburgh 2012. And then after 4 years when he passed away, that's when his estate then gradually came to Salzburg.
That was a brief but necessary look at Edith Tudor Hart's estate and at how material that had long been dispersed has recently come together at Futterhof. With that context in mind, let us now turn to Edith Tudor Hart herself, to her life, her political commitments, and above all, to her photographic work.
Edith Tudor Hart's social background, she was born in Favoriten, a working class district of Vienna, and her father, Wilhelm, ran together with his brother, Philip, the first socialist bookshop in Vienna. So the so-called Brüder Suschitzky, Brother Suschitzky bookshop was a well-established bookshop in Vienna, mainly focusing on politics, economy, philosophy, sexual education, basically trying to enhance the working class interests. And Edith came from a very enlightened left-wing or social democratic milieu. So her parents, originally Jewish though, they had their name crossed off the list, so they weren't practicing, but they were intellectuals, and Edith came from the background. She was, in a way, politically more radical than her parents. So she joined the Communist Party and studied at the Frauenerwerbsverein in Vienna. When she started her education as a Montessori kindergarten teacher, she was still quite young. She was 16 years old. And then was allowed to go to England to join a course with Maria Montessori herself in 1925. And that's when she met Beatrix Tudor Hart, another Montessori teacher, and her older brother, Alexander Tudor Hart, later became Edith's husband. And she went to England a couple more times, 1927 and 1929. And worked at a kindergarten there as well. And then later, after she started being a Montessori kindergarten teacher, she decided to become a photographer. Some of her first photographs show children, and she started working at the Haus der Kinder, a very progressive institution for children from a working class background in Vienna, and documented the environment there and published in newspapers like Der Kuckuck. She always came back to those topics. Children were one of her main motives. And I think this has been a little bit underrepresented so far in the art discourse. And also later in Vienna, after her migration, she had a little son with special needs. And she started in depth looking at institutions for children with special needs and documented them throughout her life, mainly in the 40s and 50s. Most of her work, aside from her commercial work that she used to basically earn some money, was focusing on children. Bruno Frey, he published a book, Das Elend Wiens.
which is in English, The Misery of Vienna,
where together with Hans and Anton Bock, two photographers, brothers, documented the misery of Vienna at that time. And Bruno Frey published his work at the Anzengruber Verlag, which was her father's publishing house. So I suppose she must have known those photos from Vienna's misery in the 20s. And some of her early works, already like a couple of years before she started studying at Bauhaus, addressed this misery, where she goes and sees families in their living conditions and documents the children on the street as well. So I think that has been a big influence for her. And then aside from that, obviously there's this political component. A lot of her work centers around demonstrations, people on the streets, poverty. So it paints a picture of, yeah, Vienna's a social class at that time. And she is very interested in the ability of the photographic medium to educate people and educate the working class in general. She has used the photographic equipment before she studied at Bauhaus, but I think maybe it was more an amateur sort of an idea of trying to express own political views through the photographic medium. And her first projects were mainly reportages she did out of own interest. She would basically go out into streets, document, or she would photograph at the Haus der Kinder in Vienna, and then she would approach newspapers. A few early examples are photography prizes that she won at the Kuckuck, for example. So she would hand in her photos and just document Vienna at that time. A lot of those portraits or street photographs, people look into the camera. They're aware of what they're doing. She's not interested in this snapshot photography where she disappears behind the camera. She is also using a medium format camera, not a Leica. So she is engaging with people. In a lot of those book publications that she did, she's especially naming them as well. So they're described in the text. For example, she published in Margaret Spring Rice, Working Class Wives. And there she's talking about the women as well that she met. So it's quite interesting how she engaged with them. There is a couple photos where she documents children on the streets, dirty and poverty. But it's quite interesting because some of these photos still compose some sort of humoristic approach even. Like some children are smiling. They don't necessarily all look miserable. There's one photograph that I remember that I found quite striking because she visits a family and the little child is holding a print of a newspaper. And I wasn't able to identify where it has been published, this article that the child is holding. But it seems to be more of like a document of her going back to the family. So those photos show the mother cleaning a house on the newspaper, and she goes and shows the newspaper to the family in their home environment, which I found quite interesting to see that she has very much been engaged with the people she photographed and in contact and showing them where their photos have been published later. Mm-hmm. I think her main influence must have been Alexander Tudor Hart, who was already a member of the Communist Party in Great Britain. And in some of her private letters that are at the National Archives in London, some of her letters that she wrote to Alex, she's specifically saying, you are the one that educated me, who was responsible for my political education. So I suppose he was a huge influence for her, taking her to also these communist demonstrations, one of them in Trafalgar Square, where later she was expelled from the country in 1931. So I think he must have been a main influence for her. But before that, she also, because when she studied at Bauhaus from October 29 to April 1930, that's when she also joined Kostufka, so the communist student faction at the Bauhaus. So there must have been some from like the late 20s ongoing, you know, political enlightenment going on in her life. There is no clear document on what or who made her decide to go to Bauhaus, especially. But in the 20s, photography became a subject at art universities or at the academies. And I mean, Vienna, for example, with the Höhere Grafische Bundeslehrversuchsanstalt, where her brother studied, represented more of a conservative or technical approach, whereas the Bauhaus was more of a holistic experimental approach. So I don't know what or who made her decide to go to Dessau, but I suppose she wanted a more of a engaged experimental approach in general. And I also suppose she was quite interested in Kostufra and this more like left-wing idea behind photography. But Kostufra also wanted a more of a documentary-based approach in the photographic medium as well, which I suppose she found interesting.
Let us slow down for a moment and look at the wider situation of photography around 1929, the year Edith Tudor Hart decided to study at the Bauhaus. By then, photography had changed rapidly. The Leica 1, presented at the Spring Fair in Leipzig in 1925, had introduced a much smaller and more mobile 35mm format, a format previously exclusively used in cinema film. Compared to the heavy plate cameras with glass or sheet negatives, the Leica opened up new possibilities for more flexible working outside the studio. Its limitations, however, also shaped the look of many surviving photographs: small formats, shallow focus, and sometimes a slight blur. In 1929, the Rolleiflex offered another important step forward. This twin-lens box camera, with a separate viewfinder opening at the top, soon became a preferred tool for professional photographers and artists, among them Florence Henri, whom you may remember from an earlier episode of Bauhaus Faces. The same year also saw one of the most influential photography exhibitions of the interwar period, Film and Photo, or FIFO for short, in Stuttgart. Between May and July 1929, it brought together the new visual languages of modern photography and film, precisely the kind of experimental atmosphere into which Edith Tudor Hart was stepping. And 1929 was important for the Bauhaus as well. Hannes Meyer, who had become the school's second director in 1928, established photography as a class and invited Walter Peterhans to lead it. Most publications simply give the year, not the exact moment, and I have to admit my own publication, Bauhaus Photo from 2014, doesn't either. But the Bauhaus Journal offers a useful clue. In the April to June 1929 issue, Walter Peterhans is mentioned as a new teacher at the Bauhaus. So, it seems likely that the photography class began in the summer semester of 1929, when Edith Tudor Hart arrived in October. She was joining it in its second semester. At the same time, the Bauhaus under Meyer was becoming increasingly politicized. The communist student faction Kostufa grew more active, a development that would eventually contribute to Meyer's dismissal in 1930. We have already touched on this context in the episodes on Hannes Meyer, Ettel and Ernst Mittag, and Tibor Weiner, so those might be interesting companions to this episode. I will link them for you in the show notes. While there's abundant material on Edith Tudor Hart's life in Vienna and later in Britain, very little survived from her 6 months' stay at the Bauhaus in Dessau. Let us now return to Stefanie Pirker and ask what we can know about this brief but important period.
So there is a school certificate saying that she studied at Bauhaus from the 29th of October 1929, there only the short window till the 15th of April 1930. So just a few months, actually. Wolfgang Suschitzky writes about Edith and says that she attended Walter Peterhans' photography course, where she learned all the technical background. And there is a school certificate saying that she participated in courses like artistic drawing, material studies, chemistry, descriptive geometry, lettering, and life drawing. But there is not so much known about what especially she did there. There's only one photographic document showing her and her cousin, Carla Suschitzky, who was a dancer and visited her in Dessau. And it shows the two women on the balcony of the student house in Dessau. There are a few letters like how much she enjoyed studying there and that time. And there's one interesting one from December 1930, so after her studies, where her friend Erich Lichtenthal, a Hungarian architect who also studied at the Bauhaus, so somebody she must have met there, is asking her if there is a possibility for him to come to London and find a job. And he is suggesting to establish furniture design shop together with her in London. So she has been in contact with some of the students that she met in Dessau. There's nothing that I could say that was directly taken in Dessau, the negatives mainly show Vienna in the 1930s and then later the rest she did in the UK. There is quite a fascinating trace, a collage that she made around 1929, which shows die neue Frau der Zukunft, the new modern woman of the future. The collage itself is part of her scrapbook, basically a book that she made herself where she was collecting newspaper clippings. And this collage shows a young woman in full movement throwing a ball. And in the background, we can see a hunting scene, the victorious hunting scene, and some women climbing up a mountain. So it's basically the idea of female participating in society and moving full force and power into a new generation. And this collage is quite fascinating because it already cites some of her inspirations from England. So some of these clippings are from the Queen Mary's altar. Plus, also this clipping of the young woman is on the cover of the Arbeiter Illustrierte Zeitung, so a German left-wing newspaper. It is not clear if the cover itself was from Edith, the photograph, because the cover has been published in 1931 and the collage has been made approximately 29, but the negative is not in Edith's estate. So it's not clear to trace the original photographer of the cover. But she is using this photograph for her collage, and it's an early, very interesting experimental approach in her photographic work. She had a few, and again, one where I can't attribute it to her 100%, but I suppose it's hers. It has been in the family's estate from 1928, this collage called Die Großstadt, so the big city or the metropolis. And in the back of the collage, it's written Suschitzky 28. And Suschitzky, so her name at the time was Edith Suschitzky, but also there was Wolfgang Suschitzky. I've spoken to the family, and Wolfgang Suschitzky's children don't believe it's his work because, as far as they know, he has never experimented with collages in that way. He wanted a more like naturalistic approach studying in Vienna. So it might as well have been her collage. It's a fascinating object because it's a direct reference to Walter Ruttmann's Berlin Symphonie der Großstadt. So she's referencing, you know, all these montage ideas around the metropolis at that time. And the photograph itself shows young women kind of smiling and in the sun with distorted skyscrapers in the background and very dynamic, progressive sort of approach of the hustling and bustling of the big city, basically. Mm.
At this point, it is worth making a brief detour to Walter Ruttmann's 1927 film Berlin, die Sinfonie der Großstadt, known in English as Berlin, Symphony of a Metropolis. It is a silent black and white film accompanied by music, a semi-documentary, largely non-narrative portrait of Berlin over the course of a single day. We move from the quiet early morning into work, traffic, leisure, nightlife, and raving entertainment. But instead of following individual characters, the film creates meaning through montage, movement, and repetition. In this sense, Ruttmann's film freezes time in Berlin in the mid-1920s, a time before the Great Depression hit, before the Nazis took over, and before the Second World War left one-third of the city in ruins. It is an experimental film, even in a decade that produced works such as Metropolis, Nosferatu, and Battleship Potemkin. Films that changed the cinematic world forever. The film's sense of acceleration, the fast-moving trains, cars, machines, and crowds that seem to never stop moving, create the image of a modern metropolis constantly in motion. These sequences are repeatedly contrasted with quieter, almost isolated moments. People and animals in empty streets, individual gestures, brief pauses with the urban rhythm, or bird's views of the city. The recurring motif of the clock structures the film and reminds us that this day in Berlin is passing, hour by hour, image by image. And this brings us back to Edith Tudor Hart. The logic of montage, contrast, and social observation that shaped modern film culture also resonates with the collages and her photographic work. Starting with her early collages, she combines images not only to show modern life, but to argue and to make a point about it.
there's a couple more collages that might be interesting that she later did in the 30s when she was already immigrated to the UK. So after working with Isochon and Giacomolo Pritchard, she started publishing her first works in the UK in the newspaper The Listener. And there she has been using a collage techniques for covers. So there is one example from the 10th of January, 1934, where she is again showing the big city, the metropolis, and it's showing a man holding his ears because of the noise of the big city. So that's quite an interesting example where she's exploring that collage style in her work a little bit further. Some of her early photographs, there's this quite well known where she is showing Vienna's Ferris wheel from a quite high up bird's eye perspective. That's again one of those rare, very graphical works that she did in the 30s, and that in direct reference to Moholy Nagy's Berlin Radio Tower photograph, for example, would work. Or also she's quoting Sepp Nowak, another photographer in Vienna at the time, did similar work. So she must have known those references and directly worked with them. I have another example, maybe, if we're talking about these references, which was quite an interesting trace. So I already mentioned she published in this Viennese newspaper, Der Kuckuck, which was established by the Social Democratic Party. So it was like a left-wing illustrated magazine. And there is this article that I also again mentioned, Was will der neue Kindergarten? What does the new kindergarten want? One of her early published contributions. And in the same newspaper, there is one page, page 15. So it's the issue from 27th of September, 1931. And there is this one article saying, Ein Hundeleben, a dog's life. And it's about the misery of people at the time. And it shows people in Viennese slums and compares it to dogs that sometimes have better lives. So a dog at a dog parlor who's being groomed. And it's really interesting because there is two photographs from anonymous photographers, but later she references it like one-on-one nearly. So she took photos of Vienna's slums as well, which pretty much look very similar to those examples that have been published in the Kuckuck. And in the UK, she works together with Pearl Binder, a lyricist, a poet and artist, who wants to do a book with her together called Rich Man, Poor Man, where they compare the poverty and the rich aspect of London and society, where then Edith takes photos at the dog parlor as well. So she's sort of referencing those images, those stories she has seen in Viennese newspapers with her own photographs again. So for this, she's using only her photographs, but she has written texts about her own photographic work in newspapers. And a very interesting one that is in direct connection with the Bauhaus is actually her first published article in newspapers in general, which is in the Commercial Art magazine. So she published her first article in a British newspaper in March 1931, so while she was still in Vienna. That article is about the Bauhaus and Dessau. So she is writing about Bauhaus and those political ideas and why it is such an important school for artists. And she also talks about Hans Meyer as the director. And she shows not her own photographs, she shows one of Lucia Moholy of the Bauhaus. And it is an interesting example because that is a very rare publication in the UK, so early talking about the Bauhaus in 1931. Maybe I should just read out a quote here. So she talks about the qualities of how art in general is taught at the Bauhaus and also why there is a movement towards collectivism. And she says, it is undeniably the film rather than the painted picture, which has a hold on the masses, that the dance and the play are moving towards collectivism, that what matters is not longer only the star, but the ensemble. And further, she also says, painting may be dead, art is not, she will only change her appearance. So it's got a lot of political engaged ideas behind that as well. And she's comparing the Bauhaus and the taught ideas of Futemas in Moscow as well. And so those ideas of a collective art in general. I find it really hard to compare Edith to the heart with specific photographers, especially Bauhaus photographers, because I feel like her work has mainly this social idea behind it. It's very close to a human being and their environment, mainly looking at working class ideas as well. And she is exploring some graphical or experimental aspects in her early work, but she's not particularly seeing herself as an architecture photographer, for example. I see less of these graphical aesthetic explorations that Lucia, for example, did in her work. And those architectural photographs that Edith did, also later with Isaacson, have much more to do with the social component of, with the idea of social housing and that change as a with a political component when it comes to building in the UK in the 1930s and 40s. This is a little bit unclear why exactly she moved back to Vienna. She traveled around a little bit, and those years, 1930, 31, and 32, there are some gaps in her biography. The British Security Service that has surveilled her throughout her life, they believe that she might have even done some Secret Service work for the Russian Intelligence Service at that time. She has traveled a bit, so there is a postcard in her estate, for example, from 1931, sent from Paris to her mother, so she must have been in France at that time. But she was mainly back in Vienna and starting a career as a photo reporter, so most of her work, 1930-31, show street scenes in Vienna, communist demonstrations, 1st of May gatherings, so they show like the political change of the city at that time. The idea of Red Vienna at the time, so the Social Democratic Workers' Party, has been politically in charge of the city for a long time, so enhancing workers' rights and movements. And as then 1932, Engelbert Dollfuss came into power, he slowly dismantled democracy at that time. And through Dollfuss' dictatorship, basically the Communist Party and also the National Socialist Party became illegal, which made Edith to the heart as a Communist Party member doing illegal party work at that time. And in May 1933, she was caught delivering communist propaganda letters, carrying them with her, and went to prison for a month. Some of her photographic work also has been confiscated. So she was released after a month, 1933. And then she quickly got married to Alexander Tudor Hart in August and left the country in October. So moved to England and emigrated there, which from that perspective at that time has saved her life. There's nothing left from the documents that are available today, and most of them are held by the National Archives in Kew in London. There is a lot of letters from 1930-31, so before she was imprisoned, love letters that she wrote to Alexander Tudor Hart, and where he has still been in his first marriage, and she has been like very unhappy about the fact that they could not officially be together. And she has been talking about marriage and wanting children with him, and when he finally made that move, got divorced, and then 1933, basically married her and saved her to be able to become a British citizen. But there is no trace or no documents about her talking about that imprisonment. This one photograph showing Hakenkreuze im Schatten, it shows the political change, and there is photographs showing barricades on the Operngasse, or one showing arrests where she basically has tried to document what was going on in the city. And those are from 1932 and 33, but just a few rare examples showing those political turmoils at that time. Unfortunately, her father Wilhelm Suschitzky, once the National Socialists took over, or like the Social Democratic Parliament was slowly dismantled, he committed suicide. And her mother stayed in Austria until 1938. And there is traces of Edith being able to get her to England via Belgium. So there is a document stating that Edith traveled to Brussels. There are a few photographs of streets in Brussels as well in her estate. And I don't know how her mother managed to get from Vienna to Brussels, but she was able to then take her mother Adele with her, who then lived with Edith for a long time. And later also when Edith stopped her career as a photographer in the 1950s and settled in Brighton, that's where she lived with her mother. The astonishing fact about her photographic career that she was still able after immigration to establish quite a successful career as a photographer in London. So she moved to London with Alexander and she started a studio in Haverstock Hills or Hampstead, quite close to where the Icicon building was built, through her sister-in-law, Beatrix Tudor Hart, who was good friends with Jack and Molly Pritchard. She got connection to the Pritchard family, and in her estate, there is a photo shooting of the family with their kids, so basically a commercial of the work that she did. And then Jack Pritchard, who built the Icicon flats or Lawn Road flats at that time, modernist building complex in North London, asked her to take photos of the building process and of the opening party in 1934. So she documented that for a year.
A white, modern apartment block in a quiet London neighborhood may seem like a side note at first, but Lawn Road Flats, also known as Icicon Flats, became one of the key addresses for the Bauhaus in exile. The apartment building was commissioned by Jack and Molly Pritchard. Jack was a furniture entrepreneur, Molly a psychiatrist, and far more than a secondary figure in the project. She played a crucial role in shaping the concept of Lawn Road Flats, drawing up the brief for the architect. It was based on the idea of the minimum flat, compact modern living spaces designed for mobile professionals with few possessions and little need for traditional domestic arrangements. The ambition was clear. The Pritchards wanted a building that spoke the language of contemporary modernism. Wells Coates, the Canadian architect they chose, had not yet built a house before. Before beginning his design on Lawnwood Flats, he traveled with Jack Pritchard and Serge Shemaev, a Russian-born British architect, to Germany and visited modern buildings in Dessau and Berlin. When he returned, he immediately developed a design that clearly echoed several Bauhaus buildings. And to be honest, it really looks like a mashup of the Bauhaus building in Dessau and the trade union school in Bernau, but with an individual note that makes it special. In her book, Through a Bauhaus Lens, which I love so much, not only because of the content, but also because of the book cover that unlocks a glimpse of some visitors on the roof of Icicon Flats through a literal hole, a design that was also used for the first Christmas card of the building. Stephanie Pirker describes in this book the photographic series of Edith Tudor Hart on the construction of the building. She also photographed the many people involved in its creation. Concrete workers, plumbers, designers, and admirers that gathered at the inauguration. The Icicon Flats soon became important in another sense as well. Jack and Molly Pritchard opened the building to architects, artists, and intellectuals who were about to leave continental Europe. For many former Bauhaus members, it became a first point of contact in Britain. Among them, Walter and Isa Gropius, Marcel Breuer, Laszlo and Sybil Moholy-Nagy, and their daughter Hatula. Jack Pritchard also offered some of them early work opportunities through his furniture company, Icicon. In this way, the Icicon flats played a crucial role in the emigration histories of Bauhaus artists and designers who were heading west. And for Edith Tudor Hart too, Jack Pritchard became an important contact, someone who helped open the door to further photographic commissions.
Through Jack Pritchard, she was then able to get in contact with Richard S. Lambert, the editor of The Listener, where then her first photographs appeared in British newspapers. And from there, she slowly made a living as a photographer and documented London. She moved with her husband, Alexander, who was working as a doctor in Wales for a little bit in 1935. She moved to Wales and documented the living situation there, and published photographs in different newspapers and books, and mainly with that idea of social change, health, female rights, all of that, and yeah, was able to make a living. So she photographed, for example, the South London Hospital for Women and Children in 1935, together with another emigrated photographer, German photographer Grete Stern.
While Grete Stern did not study at the Bauhaus herself, her connection to it is very close. In 1927 and 1928, she apprenticed in Walter Peterhans' studio in Berlin, the same Walter Peterhans who would establish the photography class at the Bauhaus in 1929. It was also in Peterhans' studio where Grete Stern met another young and aspiring photographer, Ellen Auerbach. Together, they later ran the successful photo and advertising studio Ringel und Pitt in Berlin in the 1930s. Their work became known for its wit, visual complexity, and often surrealist humor, qualities that clearly reflect Peterhans' influence. The Bauhaus connection continued through their personal relationships as well. Stern's later husband, the Argentinian photographer Horacio Coppola, studied at the Bauhaus, as did Ellen Auerbach's later husband, Walter Auerbach. After a short period in London, Grete Stern and Horacio Coppola emigrated to Argentina for good. There, they became leading figures in modern photography. And I promise here and now, one day there will be an episode of Bauhaus Faces about them too. But for now, let us return to Stefanie Pirker and to Edith Tudor Hart's and Grete Stern's joint publication.
They documented this fairly new building that was specialized on female and children health. So it was run by female doctors and nurses for female patients. And she and Grete documented the institution and published this little booklet on female health, which was quite interesting. And this red thread of female life and work conditions goes through her work at that time. So there's also that book she did for Marguerite Spring Rice called Working Class Wives, The Health and Conditions from 1939. Or another publication she did in the early 40s was called Food and the People from John Boyd Orr, which was all about feeding British society, feeding British children the right way so they could be healthy and prosperous. So she had a son with Alexander together. Her son Tommy was born in 1936. And then Alexander moved on to be a doctor for the Spanish Civil War. And slowly Edith and Alexander kind of like moved apart from each other and eventually got a divorce in 1944. And Edith at that point then was a single mother looking after her son Tommy. There's tons of photographs of young Tommy playing, laughing, Edith having that quite enlightened, progressive attitude as a Montessori kindergarten teacher, the way she documented her son. And she was using a lot of these basically private material for newspapers, articles, covers for picture posts, for example. There are a couple of photos of Tommy playing on the cover of picture post, which are quite striking. And Tommy, at that time, he was diagnosed with schizophrenia. From modern perspective, it was probably some form of severe autism. And the older he got as a young teenager, Edith wasn't able to look after him anymore. So she was searching for an institution that could look after him and visited institutions all over the UK. And one that she worked with closely was the Kempel School Movement, which was founded by another Austrian emigre, Dr. Karl Koenig. And that now international movement, the Kempel School Movement, was something completely new in the 40s. And Edith went there together with her son. And not only was she searching for special care for him, but she was also documenting those institutions and publishing it in British newspapers to basically further awareness for British society that children with special needs, that there are institutions for them that could help the parents and provide the care that they needed. The Kempel School she visited three times, and she published an article called A School Where Love is a Cure in Picture Post magazine as well. So these images show the children in the environment, during music class, outside in the gardens. And it is interesting starting to read a little bit about the pedagogic concepts of that school in general, because there are some key concepts of how they want to include the children into learning and growing, and aspects like growing their own food, farming is quite important for them as well. And Edith tries to illustrate those key components of the educational aspects. It's also interesting that coming back to the dancing, so Edith's aunt, Olga Suschitzky, had quite a successful dance school in Vienna, and her daughters, Ruth and Carla, Ida's cousins were successful dancers in Vienna at that time. So she must have known these progressive ideas of body movement and dance in Vienna in the interwar period, which she later translates into her photographs when she starts documenting those new modernist dance movements at schools in the UK. It's also interesting that Rudolf von Laban, a dance educator who brought a lot of these progressive ideas to the UK, also an emigrated artist, there's photos of him, traces of workshops that he did for British teachers in Edith's estate. So she must have known Rudolf von Laban and his ideas of dance and movement, which were later brought into the British educational system. And one of Edith Tudor Hart's probably biggest projects that she then did in the UK was a two-part syllabus for movement in schools called Moving and Growing in 1952 and 53, where she illustrates young children at schools and how to dance, how to grow, trying to enhance a freer, less rigid idea of dancing or movement in schools in general. I mean, she always came in with the social angle, like the human element was quite important to her. She would always document living conditions, people, and their environment. She would look them directly into the eye. A lot of those photographs are actually quite positive, directly engaging with them and quite close to her motives as well. She didn't do some sort of snapshot photography. People were aware of having their photograph taken. I would say she was, in that sense, probably even like a classic social documentarist in ways, but with that political component of aiming for helping for the better and changing society through her photographic work. I would say she was mainly a social documentarist, and that was her main aspect. And then there is this small fractions of artistic explorations she did throughout the Bauhaus and her commercial work as well. I tried throughout my PhD thesis to look at all these different facets and aspects of her work. So that's also how I'm structuring it. One chapter is looking at her artistic engagement, and one is looking at the pedagogic part of her work or the commercial aspects. And I just try to enhance how multifaceted she was, that we all in life don't play just one single role. We have all these different aspects to us also artistically, I would say. And I just feel like it would be good if people start to understand there's not just the spy with a camera or just the Bauhaus student, or that she worked in all these different spheres. And yeah, she was just using her ideas in a very broad transnational sense as an Austrian, as a British national. So there are all these different angles that we could have, but I don't think it's helpful just sticking to one angle to try to pin somebody down. Edith was a very well-connected person with left-wing milieu at the time, and she knew a lot of these emigrated artists and politicians. And I do believe that this narrative of a spy with a camera is a little bit out of proportion. She definitely was a political active, radical left-wing photographer for sure. Her MI5 files also state in the 60s, they describe her more as a so-called go-betweener. So somebody that was politically highly aware and knew a lot of people and connected them. There is no proper certain proof of her being a spy for Russian intelligence service, but she knew a lot of these people. So she knew Arnold Deutsch, she knew Lizzie Philman, Kim Philby's wife, and she probably connected Kim Philby with Arnold Deutsch, who later then became part of the Cambridge Five, the spy circle in the UK. So she has been connected with all these people, but it's difficult to completely be sure what her idea behind it was. Yeah, I believe she was an enlightened, progressive, radical photographer at the time, and she's probably aware of a lot of things that she was doing. I find it a little bit one-dimensional explaining her as a spy, because I don't believe that was her main purpose as a working photographer. Being a communist and being so well connected with other politicians and communists in the UK as well, I mean, she was basically under surveillance by the British security service, the MI5, and that happened for basically most of her life. She was overshadowed, her phone was tab. Yeah, and she was feeling the pressure and actually quite a lot of nasty documents in her MI5 files at the National Archives describing her appearance and the state of her flat and her son. So they have been shadowing her for weeks on end. Then 1951, two officers came to her flat and they literally expressed it like that, that tried to penetrate her into her bedroom. She was like not well, she was lying in her bed, and they were forcing themselves into her flat to interrogate her. So she was having some sort of mental breakdown in the 50s where she felt the pressure. She constantly felt like somebody's following her, and they suggested to her as well that she should stop taking photographs. And she slowly moved into more of a private sphere where she was trying to find better mental health again, and then later moved to Brighton where she became an antiques dealer in the late 50s. Some of her letters at the time, she's really trying to search for help, where she's moving around a lot, she's unable to stay in flats for a bit longer. She's even trying to like join the church, find some religious ideas of finding peace. She's thinking about moving to Israel. So there's all these different ideas of trying to liberate herself from that past. So she had quite a dramatic life. There is some late examples. There's this story about her destroying some of her photographs, 55, which seems to be true, but it's hard to really find out how many negatives were destroyed at that time. But there are some later examples where she traveled to France again with her son, and she documents the carnival in Nice, for example. So in the late 50s, it's becoming less and less important for her own photographic work, but she is still trying to photograph, but probably less with this political or socially radical idea behind her photographs. Because of this ongoing surveillance through the British security services and her tragic life with being a single mother and a son with special needs, needing to focus a bit more on her commercial work as well, which was actually quite successful at the time, and then later being pressed into not being a photographer anymore in the 50s, basically meant that she never got as famous as she could have been during her lifetime. She passed away 73, and only in the 80s her work became better known again when her brother published a book on her and Robert Redford published an article in Camera Work about her early Viennese photographs. And then through the shifts of her estate, 2012, being brought to the National Galleries in Scotland, and Duncan Forbes, who was the main curator for the photographic collection there, who did a phenomenal presentation of her work that has then been shown in Edinburgh and in Vienna and in Berlin. Only then her work became more known to the broader public again. So it has been some sort of posthum discovery. I believe that it is mainly the fractured aspect of her life and work that slowly shows new facets, new aspects of it. And I mean, some of her work has not even been shown to the public before. We were lucky at Fotohof to discover those boxes, which held a part of her photographs she took in the 40s at this British institutions for children with special needs. So there have been a lot of shifts with her estate and her life as well. And I think those shifts slowly allowed people to, you know, research more and find out more. Yes, I think the last years have shown there have been some really good publications coming out. Dario Santini did a big biography on her, and there was by Museum Etc. There was this academic reader that has been done a couple of years ago. So I think people are starting to see her in a broader sense. I truly believe that there has been this focus on poverty studies and all the grim aspects of Viennese society, also UK in the 30s. But looking at the whole body of her work, I'm sometimes astonished how positive some of it is. Some of those photographs are so full of life, especially when she works with children and sees them as the next generation, really wants to enhance where they're going into. She wants a better future for these people. So I just would like people to understand also the positivity of her oeuvre, and that she wasn't just a depressing street photography that she did in Vienna and London, but also keeping that positive spirit when she was working, especially with children. I took a long time to understand who she really is, and we try to pin somebody down or paint a picture of somebody, and it's just difficult to see more of a holistic idea of somebody. And I think if you connect her again to the Bauhaus and the principles that were taught there, I feel like I enjoy the playfulness of it all, the experimental approach of not having to be forced into one direction. There's just a few examples of self-portraits, and beforehand there were only those like her smoking a cigarette, looking quite serious. But actually there are a lot of lovely photos of her playing with her son and laughing and sunbathing, and all these ideas of free body movement that was also part of her social democratic upbringing in Vienna and the interwar years, translated into her life in the UK, where she published in magazines like Sunbathing Review, for example. So I think, yeah, all this positivity and a more of a free approach, that's something I'm particularly drawn to.
And this brings us back to the question we started with. What do we see when we start looking at Edith Tudor Hart's work and life? We see a photographer who moved through some of the most urgent social questions of her time: poverty, housing, health, children's welfare, women's lives, education, and migration. We see an artist who understood photography not only as a medium of observation, but as a tool of argument, a way to make social realities and inequalities visible and to invite, or perhaps even insist on, a more attentive way of seeing. And maybe that is the real point. The spy with a camera may be more marketable, but the photographer with a political eye, a social conscience, and a Bauhaus-trained sense for form and composition, that is the Edith Tudor Hart who deserves all the more attention. The political networks, the secrecy, and the Cold War afterlife of her biography are part of her story, of course. Maybe that is what makes Edith Tudor Hart so fascinating. She does not fit neatly into just one category. And perhaps she was also someone whose camera was never innocent, not because it was secretive, but because it had purpose. A huge thank you goes out to Stefanie Pirker for sharing her research, her insights, and her time with us. As always, you can find images, links, and more information about this episode in the show notes and in the chapter images of this episode. And if this episode made you see Edith Tudor Hart or Bauhaus photography a little differently, please subscribe to Bauhaus Faces on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Leave a 5-star review, give the episode a thumbs up, follow the Bauhaus Faces podcast on Instagram, subscribe to the podcast newsletter on bauhausfaces.com, or recommend it to someone who loves photography, the Bauhaus, or complex women with excellent composition skills. Thank you so much for listening. And now, there's nothing left to say but tune in next time for a new episode of Bauhaus Faces.